The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. This week, I'll continue with our series on the 13 short stories published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker magazine. Today, part 3 of number 11. Zoe, published in the May 4th, 1957 issue of the New Yorker magazine. If you missed parts 1 and 2, they were available at our website, ncreadingservice.org, the podcast section. The New Yorker magazine dates 11/11/22 and 11/18/22. First, a recap of parts 1 and 2. Franny comes home from college in a state of collapse. She is suffering spiritually, and it takes a great deal of talking on the part of her brother Zoe to straighten her out. She is 20. He is 25. There are several older brothers and another sister. The oldest child, Seymour, had committed suicide 7 years earlier. He had been a directive force in the family and was sorely missed. The next oldest boy, Buddy, who'd been very close to Seymour, now lived in a distant college town, teaching and writing. Mrs. Glass, their mother, simply wanted things to go smoothly. She wanted Franny to take some chicken broth and clear out of the living room so the painters could come in. Zoe's important conversation with Franny led to a clearing up of her thinking, especially on the religious level. As we ended, Zoe was describing to Mrs. Glass the two books that Franny was obsessed with and which Mrs. Glass and Franny's boyfriend Lane felt like were the cause of her current problems. And now, part 3 of Zoe by J.D. Salinger. The first of the two little books, The Way of a Pilgrim, Zoe said, has mostly to do with the adventures the little pilgrim has on the road, whom he meets, what he says to them, what they say to him. He meets some goddamn nice people, incidentally. The sequel, The Pilgrim Continues His Way, is mostly a dissertation in a dialogue form on the whys and wherefores of the Jesus Prayer. The pilgrim, a professor, a monk, and some sort of hermit all meet and hash over things. And that's all there is to it, really. Zoe glanced up very briefly at his mother, then switched the nail file over to his left hand. "The aim of both little books, if you're interested," he said, "is supposedly to wake everybody up to the need and benefits of saying this Jesus Prayer incessantly. First, under the supervision of a qualified teacher, a sort of Christian guru, and then, after the person's mastered it to some extent, he's supposed to go on with it on his own. And the main idea is that it's not supposed to be just for pious bastards and breastbeaters. You can be busy robbing the goddamn poor box, but you're to say the prayer while you rob it. Enlightenment's supposed to come with the prayer, not before it," Zoe frowned, but academically. "The idea really is that sooner or later, completely on its own, the prayer moves from the lips and the head down to a center in the heart and becomes an automatic function in the person, right along with the heartbeat. And then, after a time, once the prayer is automatic in the heart, the person is supposed to enter into the so-called reality of things. The subject doesn't really come up in either of the books, but in Eastern terms, there are 7 subtle centers in the body called chakras, and the one most closely connected with the heart is called anahata, which is supposed to be sensitive and powerful as hell, and when it's activated, it in turn activates another of these centers between the eyebrows called ajna. It's the pineal gland, really, or rather an aura around the pineal gland. And then bingo, there's an opening of what mystics call the third eye. It's nothing new, for God's sake. It didn't just start with the little pilgrims crowd, I mean. In India, for God knows how many centuries, it's been known as japam. Japam is just the repetition of any of the human names of God, or the names of his incarnation, his avatars, if you want to get technical. The idea being that if you call out that name long enough and regularly enough and literally from the heart, sooner or later you'll get an answer. Well, not exactly an answer, a response. Zoe suddenly turned round and opened the medicine cabinet and replaced his nail file and took down a remarkably stubby-looking orange stick. "Who's been eating my orange stick?" he said. With his wrist, he briefly blotted his perspiring upper lip, and then he began to use the orange stick to push back his cuticles. Mrs. Glass took a deep drag on her cigarette, watching him, and then crossed her legs and asked, demanded, "Is that what Franny's supposed to be doing? I mean, is that what she's doing at all?" "So I gather. Don't ask me. Ask her." There was a short pause and a dubious one. Then Mrs. Glass abruptly and rather pluckily asked, "How long do you have to do it?" Zoe's face lit up with pleasure. He turned to her. "How long?" he said. "Oh, not long. Till the painters want to get in your room. Then a procession of saints and bodhisattvas march in, carrying bowls of chicken broth. The Hall Johnson Choir starts up in the background, and the cameras move in on a nice old gentleman in a loincloth standing against a background of mountains and blue skies and white clouds, and a look of peace comes over everybody's."
"All right, just stop that," Mrs. Glass said.
"Well, Jesus, I'm only trying to help. Mercy, I don't want you to go away with the impression that they're any inconveniences involved in the religious life? I mean, a lot of people don't take it up just because they think it's going to involve a certain amount of nasty application and perseverance. You know what I mean?" It was clear that the speaker, with patent relish, was now reaching the high point of his address. He wagged his orange stick solemnly at his mother. "As soon as we get out of the chapel here, I hope you'll accept from me a little volume I've always admired. I believe it touches on some of the fine points we've discussed this morning. God is My Hobby, by Dr. Homer Vincent Claude Pearson, Jr. In this little book, I think you'll find Dr. Pearson tells us very clearly how, when he was 21 years of age, he started putting aside a little time each day. 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes at night, if I remember correctly. And at the end of the first year, just by these little informal visits with God, he increased his annual income 74%. I believe I have an extra copy, and if you'll be good enough..." "Oh, you're impossible," Mrs. Glass said, but vaguely. Her eyes had again sought out her old friend, the blue bath mat across the room. She sat staring at it while Zoe, grinning but perspiring freely at his upper lip, went on using his orange stick. At length, Mrs. Glass heaved one of her premium sighs and returned her attention to Zoe, who, pushing at his cuticles, had pivoted a half-turn toward the morning daylight. As she took in the lines and planes of his uncommonly spare, unclothed back, her gaze gradually de-abstracted. In a matter of only a few seconds, in fact, her eyes appeared to jettison everything that was dark and heavy and to glow with fan club appreciation. "You're getting so broad and lovely," she said aloud and reached out to touch the small of his back. "I was afraid all those crazy barbell exercise would do some..."
"Don't, will you?"
Zoe said, quite sharply recoiling.
"Don't what?"
Zoe pulled open the medicine cabinet door and put the orange stick back in its niche.
"Just don't, that's all. Don't admire my goddamn back," he said, and closed the cabinet.
He picked off a pair of black silk socks that were hanging on the towel bar and carried them over to the radiator. He sat down on the radiator, despite the heat, or because of it, and began to put on his socks. Mrs. Glass gave a rather delayed snort.
"Don't admire your back? I love that," she said,
but she was insulted and a trifle hurt. She watched him put on his socks with a mixed expression of injury and the ungovernable interest of someone who has been examining laundered socks for holes for a great many years. Then, suddenly, with one of her most audible sighs, she stood up and, grim and duty-bound, moved into the washstand area Zoe had vacated. Her first blatantly martyred chore was to turn on the cold water tap. I wish you'd learn to put the caps back on things properly when you're finished using them. In a tone she fully meant to sound captious. From the radiator where he was attaching supporters to his socks, Zoe glanced up at her. I wish you'd learn to leave the goddamn party when it's over, he said. I mean it now, Bessie. I'd like about 1 minute of solitude in here. Rude as it may sound. In the first place, I'm in a hurry. I have to be at Lesage's office at 2:30, and I'd like to get a couple of things done downtown first. Let's go now. Do you mind? Mrs. Glass turned from her char duties to look at him and to ask a question of the kind that, over the years, had irritated every one of her children. You're going to have some lunch before you go, aren't you? I'll get a bite downtown. Where the hell's my other shoe? Mrs. Glass stared at him, deliberately. Are you or aren't you going to speak to your sister before you leave here? She demanded. I don't know, Bessie, Zoe answered after a perceptible hesitation. Just stop asking me that, please. If I had something really hot to say to her this morning, I would. Just stop asking me. One shoe on and tied, he suddenly got down on his hands and knees and passed a hand back and forth under the radiator. Ah, there you are, you little bastard, he said. A small bathroom scale stood beside the radiator. He sat down on it, missing shoe in hand. Mrs. Glass watched him pull it on. She didn't say for the tying of the lace, however. Instead, she left the room, but slowly, moving with a certain uncharacteristic heaviness, a drag, actually, that distracted Zoe. He looked up and over at her with considerable attention. I just don't know anymore what's happened to all you children, Mrs. Glass said vaguely without turning around. She stopped at one of the towel bars and straightened a washcloth. In the old radio days when you were all little and you all used to be so smart and happy and just lovely, morning, noon, and night. She bent over and picked up from the tiled floor what appeared to be a long, mysteriously blondish human hair. She made a slight detour with it over to the waist basket, saying, I don't know what good it is to know so much and be smart as whips and all if it doesn't make you happy. Her back was toward Zoe as she moved again toward the door. At least, she said, you all used to be so sweet and loving to each other. It was a joy to see. She opened the door, shaking her head. Just a joy, she said firmly, and closed the door behind her. Zoe, looking over at the closed door, inhaled deeply and exhaled slowly. Some exit lines you give yourself, buddy, he called after her, but only when he must have been sure that his voice wouldn't really reach her down the hall. The Glasses' living room was about as unready to have its walls repainted as a room can be. Franny Glass lay asleep on the couch with an afghan over her. The wall-to-wall carpet had been neither taken up nor folded in at the borders, and the furniture, seemingly a small warehouse of it, was in its usual static, dynamic distribution. The room was not impressively large, even by Manhattan apartment house standards, but its accumulated furnishings might have lent a snug appearance to a banquet hall in Valhalla. There was a Steinway grand piano, invariably kept open, three radios, a 1927 Freshman, a 1932 Stromberg Carlson, and a 1941 RCA. A 21-inch television set, four table model phonographs, including a 1920 Victrola with its speaker still mounted intact, topside, cigarette and magazine tables galore, a regulation-sized ping-pong table, mercifully collapsed and stored behind the piano, four comfortable chairs, eight uncomfortable chairs, a 12-gallon tropical fish tank filled to capacity in every sense of the word, and illuminated by two 40-watt bulbs, a love seat, the couch Franny was occupying, two empty birdcages, a cherrywood writing table, and an assortment of floor lamps, table lamps, and bridge lamps that sprang up all over the congested inscape like sumac. A cordon of waist-high bookcases lined three walls, their shelves crammed, jammed, and literally sagging with books, children's books, textbooks, secondhand books, book club books, plus an even more heterogeneous overflow from less communal annexes of the apartment.
Dracula now stood next to Elementary Polly. The boy allies at the Somme stood next to Bolts of Melody. The Scarab, a murder case, and the idiot were together. Nancy Drew and the hidden staircase lay on top of Fear and Trembling. Even if a resolute and unusually stout-hearted team of painters had been able to deal with the bookcases, the walls themselves directly behind them might well have made any self-respecting artisan turn in his union card. From the top of the bookcases to within less than a foot of the ceiling, the plaster, a blistery Wedgwood blue, where visible, was almost completely covered with what may very loosely be called hangings, meaning a collection of framed photographs, yellowing personal and presidential correspondence, bronze and silver plaques, and a sprawling miscellany of vaguely citational-looking documents and trophy-like objects of various shapes and sizes. All attesting, one way or another, to the redoubtable fact that from 1927 through most of 1943, the network radio program called It's a Wise Child had very rarely gone on the air without one, and more often two, of the seven Glass children among its panelists. Buddy Glass, who at 36 was the program's oldest living ex-panelist, not infrequently referred to the walls of his parents' apartment as being a kind of visual hymn to commercial American childhood and early puberty. He often expressed regret that his visits in from the country were so few and far between, and pointed out, usually at enormous length, how much luckier his brothers and sisters were, most of whom still lived in or around New York City. The decoration scheme for the walls was, in fact, the brainchild, with Mrs. Glass's unreserved spiritual sanction and everlastingly withheld formal consent, of Mr. Les Glass, the children's father, a former international vaudevillian and, no doubt, an inveterate and wistful admirer of the wall decor at Sardi's Theatrical Restaurant. Mr. Glass's perhaps most inspired coup as a decorator was manifest just behind and above the couch where young Franny Glass was now sleeping. There, in almost incestuously close juxtaposition, seven scrapbooks of newspaper and magazine clippings had been bracketed at the bindings directly into the plaster. Year after year, plainly, all seven scrapbooks stood ready to be perused or pored over by old close friends of the family and casual visitors alike, as well as, presumably, the odd part-time cleaning woman. Just mentionably, Mrs. Glass had managed earlier that morning to make two token gestures on behalf of the arriving painters. The room could be entered through either the hall or the dining room, and at each of these entrances there were glass-paned double doors. Directly after breakfast, Mrs. Glass had stripped the doors of their pleated silk curtains, and later, at an opportune moment when Franny was pretending to sample a cup of chicken broth, Mrs. Glass had climbed up on the window seats with the agility of a nanny goat and stripped all three of the sash windows of their heavy damask curtains. The room had a southern exposure. A four-story private school for girls stood directly across the side street, a stolid and rather aloofly anonymous-looking building that rarely came alive till about 3:30 in the afternoon, when public school children from 3rd and 2nd Avenues came to play jacks or stoop ball on its stone steps. The Glasses had a fifth-story apartment, a story higher than the school building, and at this hour the sun was shining over the school roof and through the Glasses' naked living room windows. Sunshine was very unkind to the room. Not only were the furnishings old, intrinsically unlovely, and clotted with memory and sentiment, but the room itself in past years had served as the arena for countless hockey and football, tackle as well as touch games, and there was scarcely a leg on any piece of furniture that wasn't badly nicked or marred. There were scars much nearer to eye level, too, from a rather awesome variety of airborne objects, beanbags, baseballs, marbles, skate keys, soap erasers, and even, on one well-marked occasion in the early 1930s, a flying headless porcelain doll. Sunshine, however, was perhaps most particularly unkind to the carpet. It had originally been a post-red color, and by lamplight at least, still was, but it now featured a number of rather pancreas-shaped faded spots, unsentimental mementos, all of a series of household pets. The sun at this hour shone as far, as deep, as mercilessly into the room as the television set, striking it squarely in its unblinking cyclopean eye. Mrs. Glass, who did some of her most inspired, most perpendicular thinking on the threshold of linen closets, had bedded down her youngest child on the couch between pink percale sheets and covered her with a pale blue cashmere afghan. Franny now lay sleeping on her left side, facing into the back of the couch and the wall, her chin just grazing one of the several toss pillows all around her. Her mouth was closed, but only just. Her right hand, however, on the coverlet was not merely closed but shut tight. The fingers were clenched and the thumb tucked in. It was as though at 20 she had checked back into the mute, fisty defenses of the nursery. And here at the couch, it should be mentioned, the sun, for all its ungraciousness to the rest of the room, was behaving beautifully. It shone full on Franny's hair, which was jet black and very prettily cut, and had been washed 3 times in as many days. Sunshine, in fact, bathed the entire afghan, and the play of warm, brilliant light in the pale blue wool was in itself well worth beholding. Zoe, almost direct from the bathroom with a lighted cigar in his mouth, stood for quite a while at the foot of the couch, at first busy tucking in the ends of a white shirt he had put on, and then buttoning his cuffs, and then merely standing and looking. He wore a frown behind his cigar, as though the stunning lighting effects had been created by a stage director whose taste he considered more or less suspect. Despite the extraordinarily fineness of his features and his age and his general stature, clothed, he could easily have passed for a young, underweight danseur. The cigar was not markedly unbecoming of him. For one reason, he was not really short-nosed. For another, cigars with Zoe were not in any patent way a young man's affectation. He had been smoking them since he was 16, and regularly as many as a dozen a day, expensive panatellas for the most part, since he was 18. A Vermont marble coffee table, rectangular and quite long, stood parallel and very close to the couch. Zoe abruptly went over to it. He moved an ashtray, a silver cigarette box, and a copy of Harper's Bazaar out of the way, and then directly sat down in the narrow space on the cold marble surface, facing, almost hovering over, Franny's head and shoulders. He looked briefly at the clenched hand on the blue afghan, and then, quite gently, with his cigar in his hand, took hold of Franny's shoulder. "Franny," he said, "Francis, let's go, buddy. Let's not fritter away the best part of the day here. Let's go, buddy." Franny awakened with a start, a jolt, really, as though the couch had just gone over a bad bump. She raised up on one arm and said, "Whew!" She squinted at the morning sunlight. "Why is it so sunny?" She only partly took in Zoe's presence. "Why is it so sunny?" she repeated. Zoe observed her rather narrowly. "I bring the sun wherever I go, buddy," he said. Franny, still squinting, stared at him. "Why'd you wake me up?" she asked. She was still too heavy with sleep to sound really fractious, but it was apparent that she felt there was some kind of injustice in the air. "Well, it's like this. Brother Anselmo and I have been offered a new parish in Labrador, see? And we wondered if you'd give us your blessing before we..." "Shh," Franny said again and put her hand on top of her head. Her hair, cut fashionably short, had survived sleep very well indeed. She wore it, most fortunately for the viewer, parted in the middle. "Oh, I had the most horrible dream," she said. She sat up a bit and with one hand closed the lapels of her dressing gown. It was a tailored Thai silk dressing gown, beige, with a pretty pattern of minute pink tea roses. "Go ahead," Zoe said, dragging on his cigar. "I'll interpret for you." She shuddered. "It was just horrible. So spidery. I've never had such a spidery nightmare in my entire life." "Spiders, eh? Well, that's very interesting. Very significant. I had a very interesting case in Zurich some years back. A young person very much like yourself, as a matter of fact.
Be quiet a second or I'll forget it, Tranny said.
She stared avidly into space, as nightmare recallers do. There were half circles under her eyes and other subtler signs that mark an acutely troubled young girl, but nonetheless no one could have missed seeing that she was a first-class beauty. Her skin was lovely, and her features were delicate and most distinctive. Her eyes were very nearly the same, quite astonishing shade of blue as Zoe's, but were set farther apart, as a sister's eyes no doubt should be. And they were not, so to speak, a day's work to look into, as Zoe's were. Some 4 years earlier, at her graduation from boarding school, her brother Buddy had morbidly prophesied to himself, as she grinned at him from the graduate's platform, that she would in all probability one day marry a man with a hacking cough. So there was that in her face, too.
Oh, God, I remember it now, she said. It was just hideous. I was at a swimming pool somewhere, and a whole bunch of people kept making me dive for a can of Medaglia d'Oro coffee that was on the bottom. Every time I'd come up, they'd make me go down again. I was crying, and I kept saying to everybody, "You have your bathing suits on. Why don't you do a little diving, too?" But they'd all just laugh and make these terribly snide little remarks, and down I'd go again. She gave another shudder. These two girls that are in my dorm were there, Stephanie Logan and a girl I hardly even know. Somebody, as a matter of fact, I always felt terribly sorry for because she had such an awful name, Charmin Sherman. They both had a big oar, and they kept trying to hit me with it every time I surfaced. Franny put her hands over her eyes briefly. Whew! She shook her head. She reflected. The only person that made any sense in the dream was Professor Tupper. I mean, he was the only person that was there that I know really detests me.
Detests you, eh? Very interesting. Zoe's cigar was in his mouth. He revolved it slowly between his fingers, like a dream interpreter who isn't getting all the facts in the case. He looked very contented. Why does he detest you? He asked. Without absolute frankness, you realize, my hands are... He detests me because I'm in this crazy religion seminar he conducts, and I can never bring myself to smile back at him when he's being charming and Oxfordish. He's on Lend-Lease or something from Oxford, and he's just a terribly sad, old, self-satisfied phony with wild and woolly white hair. I think he goes into the men's room and musses it up before he comes to class. I honestly do. He has... no enthusiasm whatsoever for his subject. Ego, yes. Enthusiasm, no. Which would be all right. I mean, it wouldn't be anything exactly strange. But he keeps dropping idiotic hints that he's a realized man himself, and we should be pretty happy kids to have him in this country. The only thing he does with any zing when he isn't bragging is correct somebody when they say something's Sanskrit when it's really Pali. He just knows I can't stand him. You should see the faces I make at him when he isn't looking.
Well, what was he doing at the pool?
That's exactly it. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He was just standing around smiling and watching. He was the worst one out there.
Zoe looked at her through his cigar smoke and said dispassionately, "You look like hell. You know that?"
Franny stared at him. "You could have sat there all morning without saying that," she said. And she added with meaning, "Just don't start in on me again, bright and early in the morning. Zoe, please. I mean it now."
"Nobody's starting in on you, buddy," Zoe said in the same dispassionate tone. "You just happen to look like hell, that's all. Why don't you eat something? Bessie says she's got some chicken soup out there. She's..."
"If anybody else mentions chicken soup to me just once more..."
Zoe's attention, however, had been diverted. He was looking down at the sun-bathed afghan where it covered Franny's calves and ankles.
"Who's that?" he said. "Bloomberg?" He put out a finger and gently poked a rather large and oddly mobile-looking bulge under the afghan.
"Bloomberg, that you?"
The bulge stirred. Franny had her eye on it now, too.
"I can't get rid of him," she said. "He's suddenly become absolutely mad about me."
Under the stimulus of Zoe's investigating finger, Bloomberg abruptly stretched and then began to tunnel slowly up toward the open country of Franny's lap. The instant his unprepossessing head emerged into daylight, sunlight, Franny took him under the shoulders and lifted him up into intimate greeting distance.
"Good morning, Bloomberg, dear," she said, and kissed him fervently between the eyes.
He blinked with aversion.
"Good morning, old fat, smelly cat. Good morning, good morning, good morning."
She gave him kiss after kiss, but no reciprocal waves of affection arose from him. He made an inept and rather violent attempt to cross over to Franny's collarbone. He was a very large, mottled gray, altered tomcat.
"Isn't he being affectionate?" Franny marveled. "I've never seen him so affectionate."
She looked at Zoe, possibly for corroboration, but Zoe's expression behind his cigar was noncommittal.
"Pet him, Zoe. Look how sweet he looks. Pet him."
Zoe put out a hand and stroked Bloomberg's arched back once, twice, and then quit, and got up from the coffee table and meandered across the room to the piano. It stood, in profile, wide open, in all its black Steinway enormity, opposite the couch, its bench almost directly across from Franny. Zoe sat down on the bench, tentatively, and then looked with very apparent interest at the sheet music on the stand.
"He's so full of fleas it isn't even funny," Franny said.
She grappled briefly with Bloomberg, trying to coerce him into a docile lapcat's repose.
"I found 14 fleas on him last night, just on one side."
She gave Bloomberg's hips a mighty downward push and then looked over at Zoe.
"How was the script, anyway?" she asked. "Did it come last night, finally, or what?"
Zoe didn't answer her.
"My God," he said, still looking at the sheet music on the stand. "Who took this out?"
The sheet music was entitled, "You Needn't Be So Mean, Baby." It was about 40 years old. A sepia reproduction of a photograph of Mr. and Mrs. Glass was featured on the cover. Mr. Glass was wearing a top hat and tails, and so was Mrs. Glass. They were smiling rather brilliantly at the camera, both of them leaning forward on their evening canes, feet wide apart.
"What is it?" Franny asked. "I can't see."
"Bessie and Les, you needn't be so mean, baby."
"Oh," Franny giggled. "Les was reminiscing last night for my benefit. He thinks I have a stomach ache. He took out every single sheet of music in the whole bench."
"I'd be interested to know just how in hell we ever landed in this goddamn jungle. All the way from You Needn't Be So Mean, Baby. You figure it out."
"I can't. I've tried," Franny said. "How was the script? Did it come?" "You said, who's this Mr. Lesage, or whatever his name is, was going to drop it off with the doorman before he..."
It came, Zoe said. "I don't care to discuss it." He put his cigar in his mouth, and, with his right hand up in the treble keys, he began to play in octaves the melody of a song called The Kinkajou, which, somewhat notably, had shifted into and ostensibly out of popularity before he was born. "Not only it came," he said, "but Dick Hess called up here about 1 o'clock last night, just after our little fracas, and asked me to meet him for a drink, the bastard. At the San Remo yet. He's discovering the village. God almighty."
"Don't bang the piano keys," Franny said, watching him. "I'll be your director if you're going to sit there. That's my first direction. Don't bang the piano keys."
"First of all, he knows I don't drink. Second, he knows I was born in New York, and that if there's one thing I can't stand, it's atmosphere. Third, he knows I live about 70 goddamn blocks from the village. And fourth, I told him 3 times I was in my pajamas and slippers.
Don't bang the keys, Franny directed, petting Bloomberg.
But no, it couldn't wait. He had to see me right away. Very important. No kidding now. Be a good guy for once in your life and hop in a cab and come on down.
Did you? Don't bang the lid down either. That's my second.
Yes, I certainly did. I have no goddamn willpower, Zoe said. He closed the keyboard lid, impatiently but without banging it. The trouble with me is I don't trust any out-of-towners in New York. I don't care how the hell long they've been here. I'm always afraid they're going to get run over or beaten up while they're busy discovering some little Armenian restaurant on Second Avenue, or some damn thing. Morosely, he blew a stream of cigar smoke over the top of, "You needn't be so mean, baby." So anyway, I went down there, he said, and there was old Dick, so down, so blue, so full of important news that couldn't wait till this afternoon. Sitting at a table in blue jeans and a gruesome sports jacket. The Des Moines expatriate in New York. I could have killed him. I swear to God. What a night. I sat there for 2 solid hours while he told me what a superior son of a bitch I am and what a family of psychotics and psychopathic prodigies I came from. Then, when he's all through analyzing me and Buddy and Seymour, both of whom he's never met, and when he's reached some sort of impasse in his mind, whether he's going to be a sort of two-fisted Colette or a sort of short Thomas Wolfe for the rest of the evening, suddenly he pulls out this gorgeous monogrammed attaché case from under the table and shoves a new hour-long script under my arm. He made a pass at the air with one hand, as if to dismiss the subject, but he got up from the piano bench too restively for it to have been a real gesture of dismissal. His cigar was in his mouth. His hands were in his hip pockets. For years, I've been listening to Buddy sound off on the subject of actors, he said. My God, what an earful I could give him on the subject of writers I've known. He stood abstracted for a moment and then became aimlessly mobile. He stopped at the 1920 Victrola, looked at it blankly, and barked twice for his own amusement into its megaphone speaker. Franny, watching him, giggled, but he frowned and moved on. At the tropical fish tank, which was mounted on top of the 1927 freshman radio, he abruptly stooped, taking his cigar out of his mouth. He peered into the tank with unmistakable interest. All my black mollies are dying off, he said. He reached automatically for the container of fish food beside the tank.
Bessie fed them this morning, Franny cautioned him.
She was still stroking Bloomberg, still suckering him forcibly into the subtle and difficult world outside warm Afghans. They looked starved, Zoe said, but withdrew his hand from the fish food. This guy has a very drawn look. He tapped the glass with his fingernail. What you need is some chicken soup, buddy.
Zoe, Franny said to get his attention, how does it stand now? You have 2 new scripts. What's the one Lesage dropped by in the cab?
Zoe went on peering in at the fish for a moment. Then, on a sudden, but apparently pressing impulse, he stretched out supine on the carpet. In the one Lesage sent over, he said, crossing his feet, I'm supposed to be Rick Chalmers in, I swear to God, a 1928 drawing room comedy straight out of French's catalog. The only difference is that it's brought gloriously up to date with a lot of jargon about complexes and repressions and sublimations that the writer brought home from his analysts. Franny looked at what she could see of him. Only his soles and heels were visible from where she sat.
Well, what about Dick's thing, she asked. Have you read it yet?
In Dick's thing, I can be Bernie, a sensitive young subway guard, in the most courageous goddamn offbeat television opus you ever read.
You mean it? Is it really good?
I didn't say good, I said courageous. Let's keep on our toes here, buddy. The morning after it's produced, everybody in the building will go around slamming each other on the back in an orgy of mutual appreciation. Lesage, Hess, Pomeroy, the sponsors, the whole courageous bunch. It'll all start this afternoon, if it hasn't already. Hess will go into Lesage's office and say to him, "Mr. Lesage, sir, I've got a new script about a sensitive young subway guard that just stinks of courage and integrity, and I know, sir, that next to scripts that are tender and poignant, you love scripts that have courage and integrity. This one, sir, as I say, stinks of both. It's full of melting pot types. It's sentimental. It's violent in the right places. And just when the sensitive subway guard's problems are getting the best of him, destroying his faith in mankind and the little people, his 9-year-old niece comes home from school and gives him some nice, pat, chauvinistic philosophy, handed down to us through posterity and PS 564, all the way from Andrew Jackson's backwoods wife. It can't miss, sir. It's down to earth, it's simple, it's untrue, and it's familiar enough and trivial enough to be understood and loved by our greedy, nervous, illiterate sponsors." Zoe abruptly raised himself up to a sitting position. "I just took a bath, and I'm sweating like a pig," he commented. He got to his feet, and doing so, glanced briefly, and as if against his better judgment, at Franny. He started to look away, but instead looked at her more closely. She had her head down, and her eyes on Bloomberg in her lap, whom she had continued to stroke. But there was a change. "Ah," Zoe said, and came closer to the couch, apparently looking for trouble. "Madame's lips are moving. The prayer is rising." Franny didn't look up. "What the hell are you doing?" he asked. "Taking refuge from my unchristian attitude to the popular arts?" Franny looked up then and shook her head, blinking. She smiled at him. Her lips had, in fact, been moving and were moving now. "Just don't smile at me, please," Zoe said evenly and walked out of the vicinity. "Seymour was always doing that to me. This goddamn house is lousy with smilers." At one of the bookcases, he gave a misaligned book an orderly little push with his thumb and then passed on. He went over to the middle window in the room, which was separated by a window seat from the cherry wood table where Mrs. Glass paid bills and wrote letters. He stood looking out of it, his back to Franny, his hands in his hip pockets again, his cigar in his mouth. "Did you know I may go to France this summer to make a picture?" he asked irritably. "Did I tell you?" Franny looked over at his back with interest. "No, you didn't," she said. "Are you serious? What picture?" Zoe, looking out over the school roof across the street, said, "Oh, it's a long story. Some French joker's over here, and he heard the album I did with Philippe. He had lunch with him one day a couple of weeks ago. A real schnorger, but sort of likable, and apparently he's hot over there right now." He put one foot up on the window seat. "Nothing's final. Nothing's ever final with these guys. But I think I've got him half snowed into the idea of making a picture out of that Lenormand novel. The one I sent you."
"Yes. Oh, that's exciting, Zoe. If you go, when do you think you'd go?"
"It is not exciting. That's exactly the point. I'd enjoy doing it, yes. God, yes. But I'd hate like hell to leave New York. If you must know, I hate any kind of so-called creative type who gets on any kind of ship. I don't give a goddamn what his reasons are. I was born here. I went to school here. I've been run over here twice and on the same damn street. I have no business acting in Europe, for God's sake." Franny gazed thoughtfully at his white broadcloth back. Her lips, however, were still silently forming words.
"Why do you go, then?" she asked, "if you feel that way."
"Why do I go?" Zoe said, without looking around. "I go mostly because I'm tired as hell of getting up furious in the morning and going to bed furious at night. I go because I sit in judgment on every poor, ulcerous bastard I know, which in itself doesn't bother me too much. At least I judge straight from the colon when I judge, and I know that I'll pay like hell for any judgment I mete out, sooner or later, one way or another. That doesn't bother me so much. But there's something, Jesus God, there's something I do to people's morale downtown that I can't stand to watch much longer. I can tell you exactly what I do. I make everybody feel that he doesn't really want to do any good work, but that he just wants to get work done that will be thought good by everyone he knows. The critics, the sponsors, the public, even his children's school teacher. That's what I do. That's the worst I do. He frowned in the direction of the school roof, then, with his fingertips, pressed some perspiration away from his forehead. He turned abruptly toward Franny when he heard her say something. "What?" he said. "I can't hear you." "Nothing." I said, "Oh, God."
"Why, oh, God?" Zoe asked impatiently.
"Nothing. Don't jump on me, please. I was only thinking, that's all. I just wish you could have seen me on Saturday. You talk about undermining people's morale. I absolutely ruined Lane's whole day. I not only passed out on him every hour on the hour, but here I'd gone all the way up there for a nice, friendly, normal cocktail-y, supposedly happy football game, and absolutely everything he said I either jumped on or contradicted or, I don't know, just spoiled." Franny shook her head. She was still stroking Bloomberg, but absently. The piano appeared to be her focal point. "I simply could not keep a single opinion to myself," she said. "It was just horrible. Almost from the very second he met me at the station, I started picking and picking and picking at all his opinions and values and just everything. But everything. He'd written some perfectly harmless test tube paper on Flaubert, and he was so proud of it and wanted me to read it, and it just sounded to me so strictly English department and patronizing and campusy that all I did was..." She broke off. She shook her head again, and Zoe, still half-pivoted in her direction, narrowed his eyes at her. She was looking even paler, more post-operative, as it were, than she had on waking. "It's a wonder he didn't shoot me," she said. "I'd have absolutely congratulated him if he had." "You told me that bit last night. I don't want any unfresh reminiscences this morning, buddy," Zoe said, and resumed looking out of the window. "In the first place, you're way off when you start railing at things and people instead of at yourself. We both are. I do the same goddamn thing about television. I'm aware of that, but it's wrong. It's us. I keep telling you that. Why are you so damned dense about it?" "I'm not so damned dense about it, but you keep... It's us," Zoe repeated, overriding her. "We're freaks, that's all. These two bastards got us nice and early and made us into freaks with freakish standards. That's all. We're the tattooed lady, and we're never going to have a minute's peace the rest of our lives till everybody else is tattooed, too." More than a trifle grimly, he brought his cigar to his mouth and dragged on it, but it had gone out. "On top of everything else," he said immediately, "we've got wise child complexes. We've never really got off the goddamn air. Not one of us. We don't talk. We hold forth. We don't converse. We expound. At least I do. The minute I'm in a room with somebody who has the usual number of ears, I either turn into a goddamn seer or a human hatpin. The Prince of Boars. Last night, for instance, down at the San Remo, I kept praying that Hess wouldn't tell me the plot of his new script. I knew damn well he had one. I knew damn well I wasn't going to get out of the place without a new script to take home, but I kept praying he'd spare me from an oral preview. He's not stupid. He knows it's impossible for me to keep my mouth shut." Zoe suddenly
sharply turned around without taking his foot off the window seat and snatched up a match folder that was on his mother's writing table. He turned back to the window and the view of his school roof and put his cigar into his mouth again, but at once took it out. "Damn him anyway," he said. "He's so stupid it breaks your heart. He's like everybody else in television and Hollywood and Broadway. He thinks everything sentimental is tender, everything brutal is a slice of realism, and everything that runs into physical violence is a legitimate climax to something that isn't even..." "Did you tell him that?" "Certainly I told him that. I just got through telling you I can't keep my mouth shut. Certainly I told him that. I left him sitting there wishing he was dead. Or one of us was dead. I hope the hell it was me. Anyway, it was a true San Remo exit." Zoe took down his foot from the window seat. He turned around, looking both tense and agitated, and pulled out the straight chair at his mother's writing table and sat down. He relit his cigar, then hunched forward, restively, both arms on the cherry wood surface. An object his mother used as a paperweight stood beside the inkwell, a small glass sphere on a black plastic pedestal, containing a snowman wearing a stovepipe hat. Zoe picked it up, gave it a shake, and sat apparently watching the snowflakes swirl. Franny, looking at him, now had a hand visored over her eyes. Zoe was sitting in the main shaft of sunlight in the room. She might have altered her position on the couch if she meant to go on looking at him, but that would have disturbed Bloomberg in her lap, who appeared to be asleep. "Do you really have an ulcer?" she asked suddenly. "Mother said you have an ulcer." "Yes, I have an ulcer, for Christ's sake. This is Kali Yuga, buddy, the Iron Age. Anybody over 16 without an ulcer's a goddamn spy." He gave the snowman another more vigorous shake. "The funny part is," he said, "I like Hess. Or at least I like him when he's not shoving his artistic poverty down my throat. At least he wears horrible neckties and funny padded suits in the middle of that frightened, super-conservative, super-conforming madhouse. And I like his conceit. He's so conceited that he's actually humble, the crazy bastard. I mean, he obviously thinks television's good enough to deserve him and his big, bogus, courageous, offbeat talent, which is a crazy kind of humility if you feel like thinking about it." He stared at the glass ball till the snowman had abated somewhat. "In a way, I sort of like Lesage, too. Everything he owns is the best. His overcoat, his twin cabin cruiser, his son's grades at Harvard, his electric razor, everything. He took me home to dinner once and stopped me in the driveway to ask me if I remembered the late Carol Lombard in the movies. He warned me I'd get a shock when I met his wife. She was such a dead ringer for Carol Lombard. I suppose I'll like him for that till I die. His wife turned out to be a really tired, bosomy, Persian-looking blonde." Zoe looked around abruptly at Franny, who had said something. "What?" he asked. "Yes," Franny repeated, pale but beaming and apparently fated, too, to like Mr. Lesage till death. Zoe smoked his cigar in silence for a moment. "What gets me so down about Dick Hess," he said, "what makes me so sad or furious or whatever the hell I am, is that the first script he did for Lesage was pretty good. It was almost good, in fact. It was the first one we did on film. I don't think you saw it. You were at school or something. I played a young farmer who lives all alone with his father. The boy has a notion that he hates farming, and he and his father have always had a terrible time making a living. So when the father dies, he sells all the cattle and makes big plans to go to the big city to make a living." Zoe picked up the snowman again, but didn't give it a shake, merely turned it around by the pedestal. "It had some nice bits," he said. "After I sell all the cows, I keep going out to the pasture to look for them. And when I go for a farewell walk with my girl, right before I leave for the big city, I keep steering her over toward the empty pasture. Then, when I get to the big city and get a job, I spend all my spare time hanging around the stockyards. Finally, in heavy traffic on the main street in the big city, a car makes a left turn and changes into a cow. I run after it, just as the light changes, and get run over, stampeded. He gave the snowman a shake. It probably wasn't anything you couldn't watch while you were cutting your toenails, but at least you didn't feel like slinking home from the studio after rehearsals. It was fresh enough, at least, and it was his own. It wasn't part of a hackneyed trend in scripts. I wish to hell he'd go home and fill up again. I wish to hell everybody'd go home. I'm sick to death of being the heavy in everybody's life. God, you should see Hess and Lesage when they're talking about a new show. Or a new anything. They're as happy as pigs till I show up. I feel like those dismal bastards Seymour's beloved Chang Su warned everybody against. Beware when the so-called sagely men come limping into sight. He sat still watching the snowflakes swirl. I could happily lie down and die sometimes, he said. Franny at that moment was gazing at a sunlit, faded spot in the carpet over near the piano, her lips very discernibly moving. This is all so funny, you can't imagine, she said, with the faintest tremor in her voice. And Zoe looked over at her. Her paleness was emphasized by the fact that she was wearing no lipstick at all. Everything you're saying brings back everything I was trying to say to Lane on Saturday, when he started digging at me, right in the middle of martinis and snails and things. I mean, we're not bothered by exactly the same things, but by the same kinds of things. I think, and for the same reasons. At least it sounds that way.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next week for part 4 of Zoe by J.D. Salinger. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.